You're listening to WRFI, community radio for the heart of the Finger Lakes, and this is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, and we're looking at childbearing, identity, gender, fatherlessness, fatherhood, motherhood, parenting, what it means to grow up in this world, and I think growing up for children and adults. We would like to hear your thoughts about this program. And you can get those thoughts to us in two different ways. One is to call the station radio. I call the station telephone at 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave us a message, and it will get to Peaches and me. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6. Or send an email to info@madeofclay.org. That, too, will get to both Peaches and me. You can also go to madeofclay.org and listen to any one of about 650 or 700 hours of shows. In the past, most of them are interviews with people about their lives, where we get into some of this complexity. But more recently, they're facing our lives, where we're taking on a single issue or a wicked problem of an issue and trying to unravel it in a way that we might live it with more integrity.
Yeah. So, and as we were talking about some of the barriers and some of the conflicts and the walls that get raised against having these conversations, we are trying to break that down. And you can help us break that down by calling in and writing in and emailing us to join into this conversation and give us your thoughts. So right. We invite you to do that.
And by giving us your thoughts and dialing in, we can include you in the panel, because we can comfortably have up to 5 people in these conversations, or maybe 6, depending. We are open to showing up with each other.
Nice.
Some people look, some people stare, some people turn away, stumbling over words as if their tongue was in the way. Some people act as if their mind is made up anyway. Some people talk, some people shout, some people shut their mouth, some people's ears are tuned out from living underground. Some people laugh, some people act as if they're looking down. Some walk in safety, that is, if they ever walk at all. Some see a world where life's as fragile as their minds are small. Living in big glass houses with their big glass walls. Wait, I'm not the thorn in your side. I'm not the break in your heart. I'm not the speck in your eye. I'm not the falling apart. I'm not your flow. I'm not your ceiling. I'm not the fear. I'm not the fear. I'm not the feeling. I'm not the thorn in your side. I'm not the break in your heart. I'm not the speck in your eye. I'm not the falling apart. I'm not your flow now. I'm not your ceiling. I'm not the fear. I'm not the fear. I'm not the feeling. Like to find a box that they can live inside. Some people never understand. Some people never try. Some people's minds are just as narrow as the truth is wide. We ought to know. Some people stay, some people flee, some see the anime. Some people find a solace in their ideology. People see a world encumbered by diversity. Well, I'm not the thorn in your side. I'm not the break in your heart. I'm not the speck in your eye. I'm not the falling apart. I'm not your floor now. I'm not your ceiling. I'm not the fear. I'm not the fear. I'm not the fear. feeling. I'm not the fear, I'm not the fear, I'm not the feeling. I'm not the feeling. I'm not the
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. You're listening to WRFI Community Radio for the heart of the Finger Lakes, and we are part of the lineup of locally produced programming. The issue that we want to address today is a little bit complicated, and one of the things that I really value about working with Peaches and also doing this show is trying to find a way that people can give voice to their concerns that allows those concerns to be heard accurately and not caught in the din of the culture wars that are kind of going on around us. And in any particular locality, they may be dominated in one way or the other, but they do tend to skew the way we really hear each other. So I want to really try to listen. And you know me, I talk a lot. So it will be also some conversation, but Peaches is with us. And I want to frame the issue in a way that we haven't yet done. And I think because in I've spent about 4, maybe 6 hours in conversation with Peaches and others about this topic. And finally, it came to me that one of the ways to raise this is there is a precious and critical quality to a child growing up that needs to be an unself-conscious act of discovery about what life's about how what they have to bring to the table, what they don't have, what they need others for. And in so we have, in our general approach to children, we have really made them weapons, or we've actually made them hostages, I guess I should say, hostages to the larger conflict between adults over certain issues of culture, race, religion, politics, human rights, that in many ways, children ought not be taken hostage. No one should be taken hostage to anyone else's agenda. And it's really hard to hear. So in that kind of a context and in that framing, Peaches, you have raised issues around gender identity, around child rearing, around sexuality, all of these, and around fatherlessness, and well as what motherhood means or doesn't mean. And those issues have been so terribly, terribly co-opted by an extreme reactionary conservative movement that has rigid notions of men and women and rigid notions of race and culture and religion. And the other end of the spectrum, which has really absolutely no respect for the fact that male and female has been a category in every culture we've ever known. It's been different. It's been handled different in every culture, and we need to come to terms with it. It'll mean something different to all of us, but kind of a no respect for diversity by kind of, even though under the flag of diversity, but absolutely no lived respect for fundamentally different ways of embracing the world. So we don't have a good name for this show, but we're diving into this. And I hope I know I've just talked for 5 minutes and I hope I haven't gone on way too long. But so Peaches, what is it? What are we talking about today?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, I became very interested in fatherlessness literally by accident when I was younger. I didn't grow up with a father, but that is not what drew on my interest. As I watched the world around me and I watched as women became more independent, which is right, and more detached from thinking that they need to have a man to exist, what I was also watching was this utter dismissal of men in general, and therefore this dismissal of fatherhood. And it started bothering me a long time ago. It was like, how do we take that other half of the world and make them insignificant in the life of a child? A child that is created by both a man and a woman.
That or by a sperm and an egg, if you don't have both of them involved directly. Right. In a petri dish.
It's the body of a man and the body of a woman that come together in a petri dish, right? However you do it these days. But there is a male entity involved. And I started becoming just curious and concerned about where all this was leading.
Mm-hmm.
It is very difficult to have this conversation, especially these days, because we are so polarized in terms of gender and gender identity and male and female, that the minute you raise an issue to seemingly protect one sex or one gender, you are seen as somebody who's diminishing the other.
Right.
And so there's a defensive posture that gets taken, and the conversation gets lost in the conversation about the defensiveness rather than the conversation about the point.
Right. You know? Right. So you noticed the issue abstractly, mm-hmm. wondering what if. I noticed the issue because I was working on what assumptions about people were making about male and female sexuality and about mm-hmm. gender roles and birth and reproduction and abortion. And it seemed like people were polarizing in an extreme right to privacy, which mm-hmm. gave women absolute control over reproductive matters and sexuality matters in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
And defining gender roles, parenting, and then patriarchy, which just gave the other side over, and patriarchy became associated with the right to life, although there is a feminist version of the right to life, which is very, very powerful. And involves looking at whole persons. And what I was looking at was equity.
Yes.
How can we be fair to the precious concerns of children and adolescents who are discovering their sensuality and sexuality, and to our capacity to create new life, whether we want to or not, whether we really understand the consequences or not, but how do we prepare people for that kind of power so that they can exercise it smartly and then raise children?
Mm-hmm.
Or whole in some sense.
That's right. I have a lot of personal opinions about this and that I'll get into later, but I am, like I said, children need to be raised to be whole people. And no matter what gender or your child is, that child is part of a male-female dynamic. I'm sorry, go ahead, Eric.
Just can you unpack what that male-female dynamic means? Because when you say that, that can be heard in an oppositional lens or in an absolutist lens.
Yes.
And I don't think that's what you mean.
No. I was thinking about this last night in terms of there's one thing that comes in the picture that I'll say first. We are in a time frame, right, in our existence where we are talking more and more about gender fluidity, right? That we cannot be locked in these binary roles. And that's really not what I'm talking about. If you're thinking in terms of like men have to be in this way and women have to, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the idea that we have come to this point where because we're doing this gender fluidity thing, or we believe that's the reality of how we exist, we're dismissing any relevance to men being a different body. It doesn't matter whether the man is gay or not.
Right. Or that's whether the man has a substantially feminine, traditionally feminine side,
exactly
or
right.
takes a traditionally feminine or maternal role.
That's exactly right. We are just talking about the fact that this animal, this male animal, like the female animal, comes into this world with certain things. They smell different. They have blood. They have more blood, I heard, than men have. Men have muscle mass. That means something. Even in terms of hormones, all those things are not for nothing. they mean something, and they translate themselves into the world, not necessarily in what you wear, right? Not in necessarily what kind of hairstyle you have, but they translate themselves into the world in very different ways that are relevant to children feeling whole, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. And because these, the biological male and female, there is a tremendous overlap. The averages are different.
Yes.
So what you say is true and science-based, but also because where people fall in the distribution, we may not always appreciate it.
That's exactly right. And we pick and choose, right? We literally pick and choose what we want to appreciate when it comes to science.
Right? That's true.
That's quite true.
What we do. And we don't appreciate the ambiguity.
That is exactly right. That's the
most
thing
often. Yeah.
But that is the toughest thing for us is appreciating ambiguity. That is right.
And then on the progressive side, they may worship the ambiguity and deny some of the kind of the real solid pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. And I personally find these things, these differences in my mind, absolutely beautiful and stunning.
Right.
When I watch animals, any animal at all, male, female animals, and how they present themselves into the world. And we're like, again, we're not talking about the way you dress or whatever,
right,
how they present themselves into the world. It is really gorgeous to me. And it is something, it's almost nourishing to a child in my eyes. And I didn't grow up without a father. And I'm still saying that it is nourishing to a child. It is also nourishing to a child to watch the interaction between those two grown-ups, whether they're married, not married, their roommates, whatever it is, but the male and female grown-ups and how they interact is also part of the package of how children are seeing the world and seeing themselves. And we're eliminating that. In other words, we're short-sighting them.
Right.
You know, we really are. We just, and it's not like you can't raise a great child in a home without a father. That's not the point.
No. Or in a home without a mother.
That is exactly right.
That's but the thing is, what you've just said is that you see that children need to observe adults interacting, whether they have sexual chemistry in that interaction, or whether it's just affection, or whether they're at complete odds and loggerheads with each other. So that they can really get a sense of what it could mean for them to grow up.
Right. All of their possibilities.
Right. And I want to just say that you don't have a horse in this race, a dog in this fight. In terms of how people, any specific person turns out, only that they, in some sense, understand their complexity and the wonder and of the possibility of who they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that you don't have the ideological starting point is one of wonder, not one of outcome.
Right. And then there, you know, you lean into that. So I love to have these kind of conversations. They're almost impossible to have, especially in a very liberal society, which is where I live. They're almost impossible to have because they immediately raise defenses.
Right. Or in a very conservative, where I came from wasn't as conservative as it's begun. I can't have that conversation back there now, except with my closest friends from high school, because we had those conversations in the early 1970s.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Even I did in the city have those conversations. You know, we're very different now, I think, you know, but that's a whole other radio program.
When I was kind of sleeping on this topic and thinking about it, what children had was also a space where they could, when I was growing up, even though there were some, you know, there was the beginning of, not the beginning, there was probably 30 years of really rigid gender roles coming out of the 1920s and 30s and World War II. But there were still enough of the really old traditional ways which were more ambiguous and less determined. But childhood also had spaces where gender separated groups of boys or girls or gender mixed groups could actually kind of wonder, what's this all about? Why do I feel this way? Do you feel that way? And when we got together, we would spend time looking and talking about what we were doing and what we wanted to do and what we didn't understand, but we weren't kind of organizing into a tribe or a gang to go out and do something.
Yes.
We were just hanging out.
That's exactly right.
And playing. But so much of what kids do now is kind of implicitly hooray for their own side and against the other side in a way that's almost gang-like, even if that's not even on the table.
Yeah. And that's the modeling that they're watching in this world, how we're just so we stand on one side or we stand on the other side, you know, and that's
but we don't stand in wonder.
No, we do not. We do not. And that the element of you talk about the element of play like that. One of the I love children have this beautiful world of curiosity. And it's not just about like finding little seeds in the ground in like you're describing in conversation about what is it that we're seeing in the world? Children have that conversation. What is it that I'm looking at? What does that mean in relation to my mother and father? What does that mean in relation to my being in a single parent household? And they work that out for many, not just when they're teenagers, it starts when they're really young. It may, the language may not be as well formulated, but it starts when they're really young, where they're trying to figure out the world around them. That's what they do. That period of their life and the allowance of that, to me, is one of the most valuable things that you could do for a child, is allow them to just be with themselves, talk about whatever they want to, say things that they're not allowed to say at home, and do that because they are processing and figuring out and mapping out their own direction, their own confusion, right? They're trying to figure that out. And they're trying to figure out, like, in the overall picture, where is my place in this world?
Right.
And it is to me, like, abruptly interrupted by parents who don't allow children to just be on their own without orchestrating their play, without orchestrating even in schools sometimes what you're teaching them about those things. They just don't have enough time to me to work together just as children,
right,
and work and figure those things out.
Right.
And that was one of the blessings of my childhood. And it doesn't make a perfect person, but for me, what it does, it makes a person who becomes very solid.
Right. Well, right. Because you know what you're made of. You have figured that out. And what I want to point out is that what you're describing, from my experience, begins most certainly after the ages of 5 or 6,
mm-hmm.
where children are kind of going out and playing and kind That's of right. defining their world, or the age of reason.
And they have enough language.
And they have enough language. And before that, they're also doing it, but they're doing it as long as their play space is not overly programmed.
That's exactly right.
And overly defined in terms of its educational content.
That's right.
And where we lose a lot of children, and this is gonna people are gonna react really negatively to this, is we have them spend too much time reading.
Yeah.
And not enough time playing.
I agree.
And because in the reading, they are absorbing externalized experiences and norms and prejudices rather than sorting their own out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree. It's just too structured in so many ways. And there's a time and a place for that. That's wonderful. But what's happening is they don't have enough time for the other. You know, I was reading that most children these days spend 40 hours a week in front of the screen, some sort of screen.
Right.
40 hours. That's a full-time job.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
That's amazing to me. And that's just the average person.
And that's 5.5 hours a day. And I've read that too.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we're talking about, and we're talking about the controlled average. We're not even talking about some families who, like, you know, take this beyond that. Right.
Right.
Where
they're
60 hours a week. Which means that they are not playing. They are not engaging with other children. They are not even communicating with their parents.
Right. And
they're getting all this external information that most of is just violence and craziness.
Right. And in a profound way, the screen time has taken over the reading time.
Yes.
Because I think for children of a kind of a middle class, high educational attainment background, probably spent that amount of time reading, but we didn't see it as a problem, but it was
we didn't see it as a problem.
Right.
And literally, I mean, even coming from a school of really upperly rich environment, those same kids spent that much time on the computer as well and reading.
Right. Right.
So then there's less time to spend in the real world.
Right.
Or with your parents.
Right. And the real world isn't some objectified out there. It's just dealing with other people without structure.
Completely. It's a wonderful thing. Or sitting and observing, for God's sakes. You know how much you learn by sitting and observing the world? It's really incredible. And we don't give any value to those things anymore.
Right, right. You know? One of the taglines for this show was that we learn the most from eavesdropping. Because our conversations are what we expect others to eavesdrop on.
Exactly.
We do it with that knowledge.
That's exactly right. That's right. And we dismiss that. And we dismiss all those. So we're talking about this specific piece about children being able to play and sit and observe and just do whatever they're doing until they have to go home for dinner. That's fine. But give them some time to do all of that stuff because that helps to create their wholeness.
Right.
Well, the same thing happens when they're allowed to be around male and females and watch them and observe them and talk to them and be a part of their lives. And that's what I'm saying about fatherlessness.
Right, right, right.
That something got eliminated.
Right.
And the child, and by the way, the child didn't do that. It's one thing if the child does that. They didn't do that. It was done to them.
Right.
And that's completely different.
Right. 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 It was they got caught in the ideological wars or the public policies that eliminated fathers' roles in their lives, which could be welfare policy. It could be divorce policy. It could be all sorts of stuff. It could be the use of restraining orders to create boundaries rather than figuring out how to negotiate conflict in a more effective way.
And this fundamental view of men as the bad guys.
Right. Right. Right.
That's their default personality. They're the bad guys.
Right. Let's take a break from music.
He was a giant, and I was just a kid. I was always trying to do everything he did. I can still remember every lesson he taught me, growing up, learning how to be like my old man. He was a lion. Were father's pride, but I was defiant when he made me walk the line. He knew how to lift me up and when to let me fall. Looking back, he always had a plan, my old man. On his hands and dusty overalls, my old man. Now I finally understand. I have a lot to learn from my old man. I'm a giant, got a son of my own. He's always trying to go everywhere I go, do the best I can to raise him up the right way, hoping that he someday wants to be like his old man.
looking down. My old man, I hope he's proud of who I am. I'm trying to fill the boots of my old man.
You said something really interesting in a conversation we were having about when kids are in those spaces, you know, they can't go. It's possible that the world is not safe for them to run into random people.
Sure.
The way that it might have been. You had made a statement about the kind of play space that you're suggesting is something where you just know where they are.
You have
an idea of who they are with. And that's it. Yeah. And that's enough. And that provides the structure. You also said something where when you came home and you were hanging out in the house and your mother said to you, get out of here and go play.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of that's your job. That's the rule for you when you're not otherwise occupied.
Yeah.
Is go play. And we've had some interesting conversations about rules and expectations, but in the culture war pairing off against each other, our understanding of rules have become much more dictatorial and rigid, like a monarch dictating to a subject, like a slave owner dictating to a slave or a master to a servant. We have forgotten that when my parents said things, what they said for me to do was the rule made sense to me. And I did it because it made sense to me as much as because they told me to do it. You see what I'm saying?
I do know.
And
I
when you have authority in a person's life, you care that what you say makes sense to them. And they do it voluntarily, not because they've been coerced. And what rules have come to mean is we have this right to coerce you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what human rights have for many people come into mean. We don't care what you think. We're going to do this anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a time for that. But
yes,
that's an extreme far down the road of having done many other things before getting there.
That's right. That's right.
But we quit doing the other things before getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was raised in the same way. And I'll say again that the older I get and the more I watch this world, the more I want to just go back and thank my mother for how she raised me. We were taught to follow the rules that she set down because the assumption was that my mother had me when she was 50, that her 50 years of life gave her something more than I had at 10, right?
Right.
That's the foundation of that. And we believed it as children. We thought, and there were some things, of course, we bucked and we went, that can't be true. And we were always wrong. I have to tell you that. But, you know, you do that because you're trying to feel yourself out and trying to find your own space in the world. But my mother, it stopped at some point where it wasn't like we were under this like dictatorship every minute of our lives. There were rules that were laid down. And then my mother said to us, like we're saying, go out and play, because what she was saying is now it's time for you to be on your own.
Right.
That's what you're saying. I've laid some foundation with you. Now it's time for me to be on your own. And this she did when we were young.
Right.
Well, we lived in a different world, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. We were outside playing. We were sitting on our front stoop. We grew up in the city. And all we did the entire day was interact with children, watch adults, even interact with those adults who asked us to run to the store with them. Our whole lives was about being socialized to the world, male,
right,
female, children, adults. We were just constantly being socialized on our own.
Right.
Without parents hovering over us, telling us how we should do things and how we should handle things. My mother laid the foundation. She said, take these tools, go out there and see what you can do with them, basically.
Right, right. And my situation was a little different in a very significant way. My parents chose to live in a way that was closer to the late 1800s, early 1900s in terms of the material production. So we ate really good food. We had almost no money. And they mm-hmm. and what we learned of popular culture came more from the radio and from other inputs. And they wanted to launch us into a world which for them meant making sure people got to college. But when people went to college, they lost the labor to run a life that was built that way. So they lost the life that they had created for us. And they knew that they didn't know the rules of the wider world. So they didn't say, with my years of experience, because they started having kids when they were 20 and they finished when they were 40, and dad died when he was 45. Yes. So it, it's, there was a much more of I don't know what I'm sending you to, but I'm doing the best that I can to send you there.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's powerful too.
Oh, I agree with you, because there was an element of that, because, you know, when you think about it, my mother's 50 years old, a black woman in a white neighborhood with all these children, right?
Yeah.
She didn't come from this world. She grew up.
No, that's right. That's right.
So she was also saying, I don't know, but I'm going to trust that. And she was very faithful. That's the other thing. She really trusted in God. I'm going to trust that what I've given you will help you.
Right. And because so many people of my parents' generation and the 10 to 15 years before them left that area, they took the defiant role of staying, but not because they thought they were less than. This was the only strategy they had to move everybody ahead. But the older people knew that in a way, taking the long view of forming a person mm-hmm. will make you a stronger person.
Yes.
And those born in the 1870s and 80s and 1890s, and I got to know them when I was little, and they showed me the kind of resolve that your mother had.
That's exactly right.
When my own parents didn't have that kind of resolve, and their generation did not have that resolve.
Yeah, yeah, and it was hard won. That was the other thing for my, you know, these things, and you know, for parents like that, it was, you know, especially for a black woman who
came from the South with her child.
That's exactly right. Who was not even allowed to have any kind of sense of dignity if it were up to the world.
Right.
This is something she had to really form herself in spite of what the world was telling her about her own abilities and her own skills and her own intelligence and her own resolve. She had to, you know, kind of craft all of this for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she also did that, you know, though I'm not implying that she did that. She also did that by watching the world around her, whether it was a black world or the white world, and watching it function. She gathered information from that, gathered strategies on how to survive, and made us, I won't even say made herself, she managed to pass that on to us and make us understand our place in the world in some ways.
Right. What you said implies that her job and her life wasn't preparing to get to a certain point. It was preparing to live into discovering what the future holds.
That's exactly right, because that's all she had.
Well, and that's, but the thing is that's all any of us really have.
Yeah.
And the problem with overstructuring children's play space is that we assume we know what they will need.
Yeah.
And we try to give it to them, rather than creating a space where we and they are discovering who they are.
Yeah. When I ran an after-school program, which I absolutely loved and was known throughout this private school world, there was some things that were set up and structured, but most of the time, children walked in the door and said, this is what I want to do. And we would try to make it happen. I want to build a two-story cardboard house, and we'd make it happen. It was amazing.
That's
came in and they have the freedom to be like, this is what I'm thinking today. Can we make that happen? And we'd be like, oh yeah, let's try to do that. You know,
that's funny.
That's the kind of environment. And in some ways, that's the kind of world I grew up in.
Right.
You know,
No.
I love replicating it, you know?
Right. My daughter's response to her brother coming home from the hospital was, I want to build a cardboard house. And I showed her how she could use a little hacksaw blade without a handle, just the blade, and cut the cardboard, and she could use sheet metal screws, and she could cut out the windows, and she assembled a house that she then took to kindergarten.
Ah, fantastic. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, so it's just, but that's, kids want to do things that make their lives meaningful as if they were adults.
Yeah, they're thinking. They are thinking things. They want
not because they are adults, but as if they were.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's the wonder.
That I think that that's part of and it really does go back to, you know, the whole situation at home, because I think we treat children very much like they're small adults.
Right.
And when we do that, we forget that they have a child world that needs to be explored. Right. And I'm not just talking about playing, like I said before. There's a child mind and a child world that needs to be explored as they're developing into adulthood or young children or younger teenagers, whatever. And it gets eliminated often, I feel, right now. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of kind of children who have this kind of despair, or they're already like, they're operating like angry adults as opposed to like just frustrated children, right, which is a whole different thing, you know. And that's a whole other conversation to have, because I think we're doing a lot of damage to children.
Well, yeah, but the connection for what you said is that they don't believe that what they do will make any difference in their lives.
Yeah.
And that is what's so incredibly painful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that can happen regardless of your socioeconomic conditions.
Okay, there's no question about it.
Yeah, because
we politicize everything with, you know, I grew up, of course, in the 60s, you know, there were politics everywhere. My mother didn't bring it into the house in the way that people do now, where children or young people are actually reacting to things almost from a political point of view, as opposed to like a developing child point of view, which is a very different way to function, and it'll bring you in a very different place as you get older.
Right.
You know, the other thing is that, like everybody, you know, we look for information that supports what we want to hear.
Right.
That's the general thing. We hardly look for information that is contrary to what we want to believe, and then figure out where does this all fit together. That's really what children do more than anything. They're kind of open to all information, you know, as opposed to locking themselves in like, well, if I believe that, you know, there should be a two-parent household in every household, that's the information I'm going to look for to support what I'm saying. Children don't do that. They're like, right, they're looking at everything and every configuration of what's going on, and they're trying to put it together to make sense to them.
Right.
And we don't allow them to do that anymore, because we push them into politics, which are polarized one against them.
Right. So your story, I know many both evangelical Christian as well as atheist progressive parents who want their children to have this is the way it is for you.
Yes.
And they don't see themselves pushing themselves into politics.
Yes.
But what they have done is they've taken a political stance.
That's right.
And often those children will either rebel against that, but because most of them are polite enough to know that I have to live with my mom or dad or both, I'm not gonna push this too much. But the minute they can get out on their own, they're gone. But they don't necessarily know how to make a life.
That is exactly right, because the idea rebelling against something is not the same thing as growing into it and looking at it objectively
or growing away from it.
That is exactly right.
And rebellion is a part of growth. It's just that feeling of the terror that it's painful.
That's exactly right. That's right, exactly. And so we set children up in a way where I find that they're really unclear about who they are. I grew up in a very hard world, in a very hard time, in a racist neighborhood. And I feel like I grew up more clear about who I was because I was allowed to explore and look at the world and play with people who are my age, or younger or older, but you know what I mean, my age frame.
Right.
And we taught each other things without even knowing it as kids. And children don't have those opportunities. Every conflict, my mother did not come outside and resolve all conflicts at all. I don't remember my mother ever stepping in if we had an argument with another child or even a fight with another child. Mm-hmm. I don't remember my mother ever stepping in to try to resolve that. She would listen to what we had to say when we came home. And she might ask us questions on how we handled it, but she never tried to resolve that. And so that gave us the skill to figure out how to resolve things ourselves.
Right. And so I'm going to just, that gave you the opportunity to learn the skill.
Yes.
And what people want to give skills, rather than give the opportunity for people to figure out their own skills.
That's right. And there are times when you do, right? But this is, we're talking about something completely different, right?
Right. No. There are times when you see somebody in distress, it is helpful to give a skill.
That's right.
It can be, unless you see that they are on the cusp of learning it, and then you just be present with them, help them relax, and they will discover it on their own.
That's right. And that's exactly right. You know, and I think like just writing back to this whole concept that we started off with, when you have those two entities, that male, female energy, also doing that same thing, like helping you to giving you the skills or helping you allow you to be able to grow into the skill, and they themselves deal with things completely differently most of the time.
Right.
Then you have a broader way of addressing the world around you, you know?
And when you said that, I then thought of an old farm couple who there was no male energy in the house, even though there was a man in the house.
Yes.
Because he didn't have a presence, and their children suffered for that.
Yes. Absolutely. You know,
and that was something that when we look in conversation about the many families in the region, that family was known for that issue.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Because we as adults also survey the people around us, and we want to kind of understand to what degree are they whole?
Yes.
And to what degree can they supplement their lack of wholeness with other people who make the whole thing more whole?
Yes. And I just find that what you just said, that observation, that looking at and observing and evaluating and calculating and reformulating, that is one of the most beautiful things that human beings do, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And allowing children to do that, it just really, that's why I love that after school program where I just sat back most of the time. Here are the materials, go at it. If you need help, I'm here, but go and do whatever you need to do. And they talked to one another, and the conversations that came out of that, and the things you saw them exploring and trying to figure out that led into talking about their parents and talking about this. It's really unbelievable and beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And we've taken that away from children. I still teach. I see it. We've taken it away from them. We really have.
Right.
Yeah.
I think this is time to take a break from music.
Good morning, sir.
We would like to hear your thoughts about this program. And you can get those thoughts to us in two different ways. One is to call the station telephone at 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave us a message, and it will get to Peaches and Me. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6. Or send an email to info@madeofclay.org. That, too, will get to both Peaches and Me. We're almost halfway into the show, and what we've done mostly is look at the context for children's play and for children kind of discovering who they are in the world, within the world of adults, while honoring their being children. What I want to switch to is for now is address more directly. How do male, for lack of a better phrase, how does male and female energy, I think, which is what you essentially yeah. mean, and it's nothing more precise, but it's also nothing less precise than that.
Yes.
How do those two things play out? But also in the tussle of growing from childhood to adulthood, how do you both trust and challenge that child's ability to make decisions
mm-hmm.
and your own ability to make decisions and honor not just your decisions, but the child's or the young adult's decisions?
Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate that? Because I think this is where we're stuck. Because many times we're asking kids to make, well, do you feel this way? And so if you do, you're trans or you're gay or you're straight or you're whatever, or you're a basketball player or you're a whatever. And you are that. And that's one piece of you. And that's what you're seeing today, and enjoy it. And we'll see what's happened tomorrow. But and then there are people who know from a very early age that they are gay and they can't talk about it, or they can. And how do you talk about it that doesn't essentialize it, so that mm-hmm. that becomes the defining attribute of their mm-hmm. their life? I guess so the second question about how men and women energy show up, I think that is they're going to intertwine here with how we engage people who are discovering who they, and how we're discovering who they are, and how they're discovering who they are.
Yeah. You know, I think that for me, even to start trying to address the question itself, we have to admit that we live in a context. We deny that we live in a certain context. This context did not exist, you know, necessarily 100 years ago in the way that it does now.
No.
So right. We live in a certain context, and that context influences us.
Right.
And that's what we want to pretend, that it does not influence us. It can influence us in one, to run in one direction, one can run in the other direction, but it does have an influence on us, and it has an influence immediately on our children without us even bringing up the conversation, because they also live in the context.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying, part of what I'm saying is that there is some small, slow process when you're a parent of trying to sort through how much of the context itself, in terms of like, mm-hmm. and I'm talking, when I say peer pressure, I'm going to use the word peer pressure. I'm not just talking about peer pressure on children, because adults are subject to peer pressure as well.
Right, right, right.
That we don't have that conversation. And because we don't have that conversation, we don't necessarily know down the line what we really, really are addressing and feeling, and whether it's purely coming from us or purely coming from the point of view that we want to conform, because we all want to be a part of a group and a club. And that is a big piece to me.
Right.
You know?
Can I want to illustrate?
Oh, okay. I in my school, we had parents during the time that I worked there, like the later years, you know, like the late 90s or 2000, there was this whole upsurge of like who had allergies, right? That was like the biggest thing in the world. Peanut butter allergies, food coloring allergies. There were parents who said their children had allergies when they didn't, because we checked them with the doctors, because they wanted to be a part of that specialized group.
Right.
And even though that sounds crazy, we do things like that.
Right. Right.
You know,
right. Right. And being, and being a normative parent, when my daughter, when we had the baby shower for my daughter and her husband, one of her friends who had had a baby a year before said, "Don't turn anybody's offer for help away." You know, the dominant parenting model was that the parents have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And it's too much for two people
yeah.
to raise an infant alone. You know, it's just, it's, you can do it, but oftentimes there, it's much healthier if there are supports that come in, but we live in a culture.
Yeah,
it's much more whole in our, in the terms that we use.
That's exactly right.
And so it, that is something that my daughter was open to, but it hadn't really been stated by the culture to her because it goes against the presumption.
Yes, it does. Yes.
And so, but because we talked about it before the baby was born, many of us have been able, and Katie and Dan have been able to receive our offers to help and to shape them in ways that work for them,
yeah.
as well as to accept things that they would never have thought about because that's what we've offered.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's wonderful. And I think it, you know, it's so interesting how, you know, look, you, when my son first had his child, and I remember he was young, and I remember saying to him that you are not raising your children to be with you. You're raising them to be with the world. Right. And that is a very different way to approach parenthood, you know? And often sometimes when people raise their children just to be kind of tucked under them and to be with them and to follow what they need them to do, they're doing their children a disservice because the children have to go out into the world.
Right.
You know? And right. I see the difference.
Right.
And so when what you did was offer to bring the larger world into their lives as support, as help, as even people you can call up and go, "Oh my God, I can't believe this happened." That makes a big difference in how, in the effect that you're going to have on your child.
Right.
You know, right. When I grew up, people had hippie, what we called hippie babies, where the babies were just passed around to whoever was hanging out in the room. Nobody, you know, nobody was worried about somebody touching their child or somebody influencing their child. Children were just, they were part of a group.
Right.
They really were, you know, and it made a very big difference in how children saw themselves and even how they played in the world. The fear that they didn't have is very interesting.
Right. I was, you, it was something, there was a thought and it's gone.
Yeah.
As happens sometimes. When parents treat their children as equals, they're oftentimes preparing them to not grow up.
Yes.
And leave.
Yes.
Because it's not real.
And they don't even realize it most
right.
of the time.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Right. And that's, that was the thought that had come to my mind that I have had a hard time digging back up.
You know, and this is not about that concept of free range children. That concept is just.
And so the child that is passed around, especially from the ages of 6 to 12 months, where the stranger anxiety comes in so strong, that child is doesn't have that kind of fear.
No.
And as long as they have a few people, and I'm going to say a few because it's probably more than one, but it's probably less than five people that when they go out and begin to explore the world, when they get a little bit older, they're also going to come back and have some stability.
Yes.
Because they cannot be passed around forever without anybody looking for them.
That's right.
When you're passed around as an infant, somebody's looking at you.
Oh, totally. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when you start exploring in an environment where people care about you.
Yes.
They notice that you need to run back to the one you trust.
Yes.
And if that one is not there, somebody needs to figure out how to be that one.
That's exactly right. When you talk about a child being, I mean, literally talk about a baby being passed around, somebody had to run in the kitchen, take my baby. And people did that all the time. I mean, strangers did that when I was growing up. Like if you walked to the store and a mother had to do something, they'd be like, "Could you hold my baby for a minute?" That's like far gone. But when you think about that.
My son was reprimanded for looking at a baby.
Exactly, Eric. This is where we are. It's outrageous. No, it's outrageous. When you talk about that and you think about like the physicality of it, that the hands of affection are constantly touching that child, the smell of that different person, the energy from male to female. When you think about that, all of that beautiful energy that's going into that baby, it is incredible and it is sustaining. It really is, you know?
And and you were talking about passing. I grew up, you know, when I started having nephews and nieces, I was 11 years old, or maybe I was 13, I guess. I was 13, and I would hold them like football, with their head in my hand and their crotch in my elbow, and I would be kind of physically active around them, and my sisters sometimes were like, "Are you going to drop the baby?" Or but it was kind of a fun ride for us all, you know. And there is generally a difference in the way men hold babies and women.
Yes, there is. Meaningful.
Right.
That's what the thing is. It's all meaningful. Yeah.
And so help, because I think this is one of the things we're not articulating. When you say it's all meaningful, what do you mean?
That your child has this opportunity to absorb this beautiful life energy from all the life that's around it.
Right.
Male, female, it has that opportunity. And that is a beautiful thing to me. And it's very powerful because, like we're saying, men, you know, when I say men and women are different creatures, I'll reiterate that I'm not talking about like whether they dress the same or they.
Right.
They're different creatures. Their bodies smell different. Their bodies feel differently. You hold a baby against your chest. That is not the same thing as holding them against a woman's breast.
Right.
Everything about it is beautifully different.
Right.
And it's powerful and it's meaningful and it creates a wholeness in a child when they go out in the world to understand those energy forces that are there to support them. I really believe.
Right. And when a male and female couple are in conflict.
Yes.
What happens is that the way the man holds the baby becomes exaggerated. The way the woman holds the baby becomes exaggerated. Because in that conflict, they do what they are, only more extreme. And so it becomes feeling like more careless or more reckless or violent, or it becomes more protective or more whatever. And suddenly it becomes something that's harmful.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Or potentially harmful. But but to some extent, children need to experience that distress.
Yeah.
But it can't be their constant life.
It can't be in their constant life. And the fact is that the truth is that they're going to experience that.
That's right. We can't save them from it.
Or outside of the house. Better to start in a house where they know that ultimately there is some support, hopefully, for them. And then it's easier for them to navigate those things in the larger world when they come up against stress, which is something we're also seeing that children cannot do.
Right.
They cannot handle any stress anymore. If I compared a child to the stress that we handled or I handled when I was a kid, it would be a joke at this point.
Right.
You know, because we don't allow children to just, you know, step out into the world in a watchful way, right? We're watching them.
Mm-hmm.
But the kids that fall down, they're the children who fall down and parents run over and scoop them up and patch them up. And then their children fall down and you go, you know what? You're okay.
Yep.
That's the way I was raised. Right. You're okay.
You'll be okay. You
or
may hurt now.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll
that
be okay.
That is exactly
I'm not
right,
worried
Eric.
About
that's,
you.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
I'm not worried about you, because when a person feels your worry, they can never really trust themselves.
Yes, 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 yes. And the different ways, and you think about this, the different ways in which men and women do that, and it is different.
Mm-hmm.
The way men and women say to you, get up, even the way they say it.
Uh-huh.
Is different. That to me creates a more holistic social orientation, as far as I'm concerned, which is necessary to being a full human being in some ways. It really
right.
Is.
It lets the child identify how those two ways can both be comforting and helpful. It also lets them have an opinion about which is better for them.
That is exactly right.
And
that
children have to have opinions
and
that
I
are
love
honored.
Them. Yeah. I love sometimes the
not agreed with, but honored.
That's right. The complete difference in way, even Peter and I, we had complete differences on how to raise Jamel. You know, his coming very much from a male point of view, that's really what it was, mm-hmm. and mine coming from a female point of view with some interactions of maleness, because I grew up around a lot of men anyway.
Right. And I was pretty and much you've like, described yourself as tomboyish.
Yeah, I was like, you know what, hey, toughen up, come on, you could do this, get back in the field. Like, that was my attitude. Always keeping watch that you were okay.
Yeah.
Knowing that the possibility is that you're not okay.
Right. I could be wrong here, but I think you can figure it out.
Exactly. That is exactly the attitude, you know, right. Where he was like, you're fine. and not necessarily watching, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but both of those things are wonderful, because like you said, it really helps children go, oh, do I want to be that or do I want to be this? Is this feeling better to me or this doesn't feel better to me?
And right. And when a child knows that when the father says or the mother says, you're fine, and they're not watching anymore, then they know that if they are in trouble, they have to ask for help, because somebody's not looking after them.
That's right.
And unless the parent is a mean person, they're going to hear and respond to that call for help,
even if they're not looking. That's right.
Because don't all have to look after. Yeah, that's right.
That's part of the internalization, that they may not be there, but I know they're real. I can go to them and get a good response from them.
Right.
You know, and that creates you know, the security that you have in yourself and the confidence, because you allow to go out and deal with it yourself. Even if you have to go back and say, did I do that right? Can I check in with you? Am I really okay? Even if you as a child have to go back and say that, you had the initial confidence to go, I think I can handle this.
Right.
You know, and that's a really powerful thing, you know, right. Because of the way men and women most of the time handle those things differently, so now you're equipped, doubly equipped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I worked, and I've said this before, I've worked with children for 45 years of my life. And I said this before, that I can probably pick out 10 children. Now, if you think about my working in the same school for 30 years, and I've watched these children grow up, and the amount of children I came across teaching, running after school programs, directing summer camp programs, the amount of children I came across, I could count on almost one hand how many children, how many boys and girls were not different. When boys play, they play differently. When they fight, they fight differently. Mm-hmm. When they resolve things, they resolve differently. When they sit down quietly, they sit down differently.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be honored in children and not dismissed for political reasons.
Right. And it can be, you can introduce boys and girls how to relate to the other.
Yeah.
Without dismissing the other.
That's right. Yeah.
And we seem, as you pointed out in the beginning, we seem to, if you are exploring and valuing one, it seems to imply that you don't value the other.
Yes. And we do that with race too, right?
Right. That's true. And for me, and when I say this now, people laugh, but back in the 80s, it was kind of a thing. The way to make a compromise about parenting, or the early 90s, was to kind of meet each other halfway.
Yes.
and it doesn't really work. And because it doesn't honor either person.
Yeah.
And it doesn't honor if there are gender differences or racial differences or class differences. It doesn't really honor the difference.
Yes. Yes.
So, and so much of our, quote, professionalized diversity mm-hmm. is fundamentally dishonoring difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, this is inability, you know, when we talk about like the compromise of meeting each other halfway, there are times when we shouldn't even have that rigid of a structure, because not only does it not work half the time, right?
Right.
But also what it says is that we are always both right. And that's not true.
Right.
That
or
is
that
not
we
true.
Even know our way.
That's
because
exactly
most of us have an opinion, but it's not really experience.
That's right. And we could explore. We say, hey, let's try this, right?
Right.
Let's try this, let's say, quote unquote, my way. And let's see, because most of the time you can see where it's going. At least I feel I can see where it's going. And you go back and go, you know what? I think we should add that into this piece.
Right.
You know? And we don't do that. We're just like, I'm doing it my way. or you're doing it your way and there's no meeting in the middle, or trying.
Right. Yeah. Or if you value me, you're going to do it my way.
Yes, that's the other one. That's exactly
and,
right.
And rather than I will meet you with a certain amount of wonder and experiment with what you need. And yes. I want the same in return.
That's right.
And one of us may be completely dead wrong.
Yes.
But we won't know that.
That's right.
Until we actually experience it.
That's exactly right.
And most experiments are not lethal. They're just kind of awkward and painful.
Right. Right.
but it's a healthy living with wonder and an attitude of experimentation is hard.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You know. Yeah. And it just makes me wonder a little bit about sometimes, like, why is it hard? Is it because we're so anxious to rush through and get to the end of our goal mm-hmm. line? You know, I wonder if that's part of it that makes it hard, because we're just mm-hmm. like, we want to see our results as fast as we can, as quickly as we can. You know, very interesting. And it makes me think about, just as we were talking about children and their development in terms of watching the world and figuring out the world, like, do we allow them the time that we can read that they need, not that we impose that they need,
right.
but the time that we can read sometimes that they need more time, you know, which sometimes with some encouragement, because you don't want to have that child who can't step out into the world ever because they're right. waiting for 20 right. years. Learn how to use the potty or something.
But, you know, like, yeah, so, yeah. No, but you know, but I guess
I had a child tell me that he was waiting until he was 7 to use the potty. You know, and that's not a decision you want a child to make. You know?
Right, right. What when you were? I think when you respect nonverbal communication. When you respect body language, when you respect the timbre and tone of a voice, you know when a person is ready to take a risk. You know when they are not ready, and you honor that.
Yeah.
And if you don't honor that, you do not have in mind the wholeness of your child or your partner.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And
some of it, like I said, like we said, some of it needs to be negotiated, because some parents are like, oh no, let's not help them walk into that development that they need to, and we know they can walk them, because children are not standing back saying, well, I really need to be this at this stage of development at this point. They're not right. saying that.
No, so that's part of our haven't been down the road.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's their first time.
That's right. So part of our job is to say, look, we can help you get there, and we'll be there for you and whatever it is that's going on. And some parents are resistant to that. They're like, oh, no, don't do that. Don't push them. Don't do that. Or they see it as pushing and things like that. So there's a lot of negotiating that goes into parenting, even if you are, I don't want to say the best parents, but even if you meet heads most of the time, there's still right. negotiating that has to go into parenting. You
right.
know?
Right. And. There's the negotiation between the parents, but there's also the idea that as parents, we will do things and fail to do things that yeah. will have damaging consequences on our children.
That's right.
That's not negotiable.
That's right.
That's going to happen.
That's right.
That's and happen. We live, and the more we live into that with clarity,
yeah,
the better it can be. It's not going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be kind of painful and ugly.
And to reevaluate, like I find that this is not necessarily about parenting, but to be able to go back and reevaluate, I think is also tough sometimes for people.
Right.
Because it's almost like an admittance that I wasn't perfect or I did something wrong or whatever it is, to go back and reevaluate and say, you know what? I know what could be more helpful at this point. We do that all the time with people,
right.
whether it's conversation. Somebody says something else, and we go back and we go, oh yeah, I know how I could be more helpful to that. Well, we have to do that with our children as well, you know, to go back and go, you know what? I didn't do that right. And I know what was wrong. Let's figure this out again.
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah.
And adult children can help parents with that.
Oh yeah.
When my mom was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, we all chose to come back and live with her a week at a time for the months that she had. And it was the only time she got to spend time with her adult children without spouses or the grandchildren. She got to really know them. And she became a mother at the age of 20 and then had 8 children by the time she was 40.
Okay.
And she had 4 children in 6 years.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, at birth, 2, 4, and 6. I mean, it was, and the 6-year-old was taking care of the younger ones.
Oh, yeah.
To help her out, but mom was anxious.
Okay.
And she was she was competent in getting things done.
Okay.
But she was anxious as a person.
Yes, I understand.
And so she never really played with her grandchildren. She watched them.
Yes, yes.
But by the time we were able to go back and live with her at the end, much of that anxiety had melted away.
Yes, yes.
Because she got to feel the confidence in what she did.
Good. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Very nice. Yeah. It's interesting talking about playing with children. Like my mother actually never played with us.
Right.
Ever. Because she saw us as completely different animals, right? With completely different.
Right. And you have an older brother or older sister.
That's exactly right, Eric. And she was busy. But what I do remember, and this memory came to me as you were talking, is she used to take us to the park every day, Prospect Park. We lived right near a beautiful park. And she always wore A-line dresses from her era, like those beautiful, like they had nice tight bust and A-line frames. Uh-huh. And so when she sat on the park bench, it draped over like a tent.
Good.
And we would hide under it. Because
You were small enough.
We were really little, that's right. And so what I remember is not that she played with us, but she was there as a spiritual force behind our play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that made all of the difference in the world.
Yeah.
You know, even in the house, we would play together, we'd be running crazy, and she would just be there. And she might call out to us for something, you know, or she might say, "What are you all doing out there?" But her spiritual energy was always there with us.
Right.
And that was beautiful to me and amazing to me.
She held the space for you to be children.
She did. She did it in a way that I didn't even understand until recently, you know. It was really incredible, you know.
That's beautiful. Let's take a break from music. Peaches, what would you like to play now?
always right. But he said, girl, it's your Second Amendment. He always played it cool.
I want to turn to what's going to probably be a harder topic, and I don't know quite how to get into it well. There are all sorts of issues around our culture's inability to be honest about the violence that is both necessary in a society to hold some guardrails, but also that is gratuitous or evil in its injustice. And you know, you could tell a lot about farmers by how they treated their animals.
Okay.
And those that were more competent human beings treated their animals with real respect. Mm-hmm. And when they killed those animals for food, they killed them quickly.
Yeah.
And they did not beat at them.
Yes.
They made it as quick as possible. And on the where I grew up, in the generations older than me, men and women were responsible for the killing. And I know you're a vegetarian and you're committed to not that, but I want to use this in a particular way. People understood this.
My mother killed animals on farms.
The sacredness of that act. and women would kill the small animals, the chickens and the domestic rabbits and the things that were there for that purpose. And the men would tend to handle the pigs or the cattle or the larger and the sheep, the larger animals. And violence was seen as just a fact. And you had to learn how to use it appropriately and how not to get out of control. Discipline was the same sort of way, you know, when it was physical discipline. And we don't, we're not comfortable about how to think about when is force appropriate, when it's not appropriate. How do we contain it? How do we be centered enough that we can use it without abusing it? Mm-hmm. How can we encourage that in law enforcement or in ourselves to step up in ways? Because we do depend on having guardrails because things can go terribly wrong. But also there's the violence that's done to bodies, sometimes for really, you know, good, I mean, for purportedly good reasons, like, you know, circumcision of male infants, you know, it can reduce the rate of STDs and all sorts of other health issues, but it's also a mutilation.
Yes, it is.
And the same way with the genital circumcision of girls.
That's what I thought about. Yeah.
You know, and also with some of the transitioning of trans persons, it's doing.
Yes.
Physically, either with hormones or with cutting,
yeah,
a change of a person. And we want wholeness, but how do we come to understand what the wholeness is and how do we foster children in that way? And what I'm, the reason I'm in the United States, we have a far higher incidence of lack of clarity about gender identity and a commitment to being trans than say in Europe. And Europe has a much worse track record for being not respectful of religious differences, not being respectful of cultural differences, but they have a far less, they've been much more successful in some ways at acknowledging some gender differences, but they have a far smaller, like a quarter or a third, the identified trans population that we do.
Yep.
And there's some curiosity, and but some of the issues is that we just aren't grounded as a people. I know this was something we've talked about, or that you have, and that's why I wanted to raise it in this way. How do we respect wholeness, knowing that sometimes wholeness involves violence?
In terms of these, wholeness in term involves bodies in terms of the kind of relating that to kind of violence in the way that we're using it, right?
Right. Which is a way of changing something from what it is to something else, or restraining, or eliminating, or cutting off.
Yeah. That's a tricky conversation for me because we live in a world where, in as much as I, of course, am not violent, and, you know, I never spanked I was spanked as a child very infrequently because I was the last child on one, and I think my mother was tired by the time I came along. I never spanked my child, and I don't encourage people to do it, but I also don't scoff at it, depending on who and how and what it is. We live in this world. And let's remove this from children because that's a different conversation. But we live in this world where, whether we like it or not, there is violence. I didn't create it. I didn't set this up.
Right.
This is the way it is. Every animal on Earth knows that. Not just a human animal that engages in violence. Every animal, even the earthworm, engages in fighting. When we don't try to understand its true context, and we just deny our instincts toward violence, we are never seeing anything clearly at all. And when you're not seeing things clearly, you can't make rational decisions about anything, whether it's gender stuff or spanking children or going to war. You cannot make rational decisions, or slaughtering animals or whatever it is. You can't make you can't make reasonable decisions about those things. So we have to get to the point where we have to say, where does violence have its place? Because clearly it does, for some reason, whether you think God set it up this way or man set it up this way, it doesn't matter. Or nature set up the way, it is here. And we use, and we do use it.
And I want to stay with the spanking of children, because my parents did, but not often. And when my mother did, she was not clear. And she would hit in a way that was harder and without understanding. And my father was clear that the spanking wasn't to teach any lesson. It was to get your attention when in some posture of defiance, you had decided that you did not have to be with other people in a way that was either safe or helpful. So the violence was meant to break through that separation.
I completely get that.
And it was never, to my knowledge, and I was young when he died, near used in another, in any other way for him. But my mother was a little out of control. Because I think she didn't really have a stomach for it, but she felt like she had to do it. And I think, you know, so your talk about clarity, that that's really important.
And it's very, because it's the same posture that people take when you talk about, you know, fatherlessness. It's like, you're either against it or you're, you know, it's just like, we're always running in the opposite, the complete opposite and polarized direction. When somebody tries to have like a simple, and I'm going to use this word, almost intellectual conversation, without the emotion and without like the triggering, without just having a conversation about who we are as an animal on this planet. That's really what I'm saying.
You know? Or the emotions are one of tenderness and regard when with, and regard when dealing with things that are incredibly painful. Like a parent who did not know what the damage they were doing by physical discipline or by simply yelling.
And understanding the other thing that parents don't understand, and like, I'm not an advocate for spanking, whatever it is. I certainly can raise my voice very well. And I like that skill, quite frankly, when you work with a lot
of kids. And you know how to modulate it.
No question about it. And to come back from it.
So you know how to escalate and de-escalate.
That is right. That some people don't know how to come back from the violence and the escalation of yelling. Because they get lost in their own emotions. And it's almost as if they forget what the focus really is, the child or with the animal, whatever it is. They forget what the focus really is, and they get lost in their own emotions of whatever they may have experienced, and they forget what their point really was in using it, you know?
And there are some people who live life in a state of emotional reactivity that the rational, in what I might call intellectual conversation, is impossible. And there are some people who are so afraid of being out of control in their emotions that they cannot have anything beyond a cold intellectual conversation about
that. That is right.
And in both instances, people don't have really good control of their visceral bodies.
That's right.
Different reasons. And getting those three to work together in a healthy whole human being is tricky. So for me, the goal of growing up, even if I'm, I mean, I make jokes about my inner Marlene Dietrich, partly because, you know, I am a male. I'm very strongly, I'm very clearly a male. I have very traditional male sorts of identities, but I also have this really strong feminine identified part. And I love hanging out with babies. Know, and raising children and being with them and stuff like that. And how much I love that was just like hit me hard when my granddaughter was born 6 months ago. But going back, it's what I care about. I don't care how people identify gender wise. What I care about is that they have a sense of wholeness and that they not make choices that eliminate them from growing into their own wholeness. We all make mistakes. We will all do things that damage us in ways that we cannot anticipate.
Always.
But I do not know what it means to have a generation of people who are biologically and surgically transitioning. You know, I do know that I have a friend who is Klinefelter's. So he has two X chromosomes and a Y chromosome, and he has a very unusual body type, and that has shaped his life in a profound sort of way that he can't change.
Yes, yes.
You
know, and, I have.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Eric.
So I'm wondering, how can we truly be supportive of people who are struggling in the environment we're in, where gender seems to be not understood or respected?
Yeah.
But individual choices almost are without regard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tricky because I think that we are in this frame of thinking that says that in order to be supportive, you have to be in total absolute agreement. And we do that all the time.
Right.
It, not just with gender, we do that with everything.
Right.
Totally in agreement. And that's another conversation, because what does that even mean to be in agreement with
somebody? But I mean, that's another conversation. But under this is, in a democracy, we have to support people whose lives we find morally offensive.
Right, that's what.
But
I'm
they
getting.
Have a choice. Yeah.
And it's not necessarily something I would go. Yeah, if I were raising a kid, I'd be like, I would not necessarily be like, yeah, go get your body parts cut off and get. No, I wouldn't. But that's not what those people. That's what most people want. People want you to completely agree with every little detail of what they felt or believed that brought them to where they're going. Otherwise, you are not supportive, and that is completely wrong. I can support anybody, absolutely anybody. I could love anybody. I would embrace them. I would care for them. It is no different than somebody going, well, I believe in this faith and I don't believe in that faith. And therefore, if you don't believe in my faith, you're not supportive, which is not true.
Right.
You know, and I think that we haven't gotten past that. And so we're in constant war about it. We really are.
I can support you, and even in a decision that I would find repugnant.
Mm-hmm.
But it is your decision, and I love you.
That's right. But most of the time, that's not good enough.
So I think so my experience has been, if you can genuinely say, I completely disagree with you, but I support you because I love you, that usually is good enough.
Well, that's good, because I do not have that.
My guess is that in some ways I lead with argumentation. I lead with a certain amount of fighting, as it were, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes that's where we come down to. Sometimes it is not enough, but okay. if they can hear and internalize that I love them,
that's right.
Then it's enough. If they then I agree with you. Then that's. But what I meant is, if I can say it and it's heard.
Yes,
it's enough.
And it's heard, absolutely.
Right. It's heard. It's got to be there.
That's right, exactly. I mean, even when you look at this exact kind of conversation, and you look at the responses through social media, which are real people's responses, even though it's social media, that there's this content like, if you don't agree with that, then you hate me. If you don't agree with that, then you're phobic. If you don't agree with that, this is the constant mantra in our culture, whether it's this conversation or gender or parent raising conversation, is a constant mantra. Well, if you don't agree with me 100%, in absolutely everything I do, then you are against me.
Right. Or at the very least, you are suspect. And are I you cannot suspect? Trust yes, you. That's a good and one. I cannot that's trust you.
That is exactly right. That's exactly right.
I will so, not let you in.
That's right. And when we, since we haven't gotten even close or near to past that, we are never, in my mind, going to have authentic conversations about this, these issues. And I'm trying to get past that, trying to infuse this with like the love and support. And I sit with you, I'm your friend. I grew up with a young fellow. We never saw anything like that before, who was transitioning. And this was like, we were young. I had to be 14. He must have been 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us had saw, and he was.
Treated, and this is 1974.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And we were teenagers, and we were part of a youth program called PRI. And he was treated very badly, like really, really badly, just because of the way he looked, and he didn't look like one or the other. And you saw that he was getting breasts. And I was the person who was like, I'm going to be that guy's friend. Because you cannot do that to a human being. I don't care what they're doing or who they are.
Right.
You cannot make somebody feel like they're less than everybody else, right, or that they're pushed out of the main frame of what we need to live, which is our friends and society and, right, and support and culture. Yeah, I'm the first person running to their defense. But even given that, right now, in this time frame of our existence, if I made one comment about, well, I don't really think that way, or I see that as not wrong, but I see that as something that it doesn't sit right with me.
It's highly questionable to me.
I would be like destroyed.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
That's where we are. And that's why we can't have conversations right now. And I'm saying that in general. Of course, there are people you have conversations with, but you understand what I'm saying.
Right, right, right. And so the challenge for this show is to try to open up a topic in a way that allows us to have really strong opinions and values and experiences and clarity about those experiences that may contradict each other.
That's right. That is right. Whether you're talking about fatherlessness or parenting, mm-hmm, children, we have not gotten to that point at all. And I'm not even sure if we will, but.
Okay. I'm not sure it's a point to get to.
Okay.
The most amazing conversations and experiences I've had are when I have gotten lost in conversation and I didn't expect to, because I was able to hear or say things that I could never have anticipated.
Okay.
And hold them.
Yeah.
And that is something that was not what I set out to do.
Yes.
It happened as a byproduct of my being curious and wondering about what was possible.
Yeah.
And not bringing a litmus test to the table.
Right. I bring to the table, like we all do, right, our lives experiences, whatever that means.
As big and as limited as that is.
That is exactly.
And something as biased as that
about,
is.
Yeah. Some things we are clear about. Some things we're still learning, right? But that all comes into the picture. But if I can't see, for me, if I can't see even the vestibule, the doorway, the framework, the light in the dark of being able to cross into that dimension or get to that goal, then that's what I mean by the point. Not that it is all settled and now we could do that, but I don't see the opening. I don't see it right now. Not on a whole scale. Like with individuals, I can see that.
Right, know? Right, right, right. And I think so for me, as with individuals, so the larger scale, there are moments when people can, in their extreme distress or ecstasy, hear or experience things that are not otherwise possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a culture, there are moments where those things can happen. And it requires a level of wholeness and maturity on the part of a leader to open up that window. We're not going to get that from our political leaders because they are trying very hard to find the 50.1% that can push them over into a majority. And they do not want to govern the whole country. They do not want to lead the whole country. They only want to lead their faction. Mm-hmm. And that in the end, and that is the weakness of majoritarian democracy. In a participatory democracy, we have to make space for each other. Because if someone does not have a space, then they do not have standing and they are not a citizen.
That is very true. But what I see, and especially here, and I haven't been to New York in a while, is that what we have done is we have taken on the model of politicians.
Right.
Exactly what you explained. We have taken on that model and we're looking for that 51% to push us into whatever it is that we feel is right.
And then we can impose it on others and justify it as having been democratic.
And that is exactly what I see is happening with gender stuff, with all of this stuff. That is exactly what I see.
I agree. I mean, I see the same thing, but as I look at that, I am also looking for those moments when there will be a murder, there will be an unexpected death, there will be an event that catches people's attention with awe that they didn't know they could have. And that is when people who are not. So for decades, I believe we need to look beyond our political leadership and beyond our religious leadership, because too much and our cultural leadership, because too many of those leaders are simply self-serving.
Yes.
Whatever the self is. And race, class, religion, politics, all of it. And what. But it means people who have chosen to live out loud with others who are not like them to then step up when those opportunities occur. And I see that there are people who could do that. Not all of them have been seasoned or tested or know what it's like to be blackballed, to be taken out, either physically or whatever, because you risk something, but it's really good. But who can maintain their good cheer even when they know that it may not end well?
Yes, exactly.
And we don't control this, but there is a joy to living in an openness which nothing can replace.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, it's interesting because those moments of like, something clicked and I'm like, I learned a whole new world of information in 2 seconds just because something opened up. I experience that all the time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I love about not only the mind, but just the existence itself. I experience that all the time. So I am always open to those things, but there is a barrier that gets created, and it's not me, and it's not necessarily that other person doing it on their own, and that we are bumping heads against often. Mm-hmm. And part of it is because we don't, for me, this is what part of it is, that we have become so politicized in everything that we manage and do, and we have lost touch with the deeper spiritual self that would have a very different conversation, because that conversation would be that this deeper spiritual self brings in the conversation of love and acceptance and support, no matter what,
right?
Even if the conversation is hard.
Right.
And that's the space that I want to be in. That's the way I want to present myself, no matter how difficult the conversation is. And I've done it successfully. There's no question about that.
I've seen you do it both in terms of sitting through a meeting that's 2 hours long and not really stepping in for 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Because you've picked up enough of the vibe of what the tensions are to then be able to speak into them with that kind of love and regard and precious value. But in some instances, we are with people for years and decades before that moment arrives. And I think that's what I'm trying to say. And so I see it there, but it's a matter of of legitimating these conversations, of living them, and of waiting for the moments when it's really truly viable. Because an opportunist will try to seize that goodness before it's really possible. And in the process, they will discredit it. And many times that's what our politicians do.
Yes, indeed.
Because they may actually have some genuinely good regard, but because they want to bend it to their political majority, it takes all the goodness out of it.
Yes, it does. That's right. That's right.
Peaches, what would you like to play now?
The song that, you know that song, Brother, Brother? What is that song? It's like from the 60s.
There was a Marvin Gaye song.
That is exactly the one. That's the one. Yes.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on? Yeah, what's going on, what's going on? Oh, what's going on, what's going on? Oh, right, right now.
You're listening to WRFI, Community Radio for the Heart of the Finger Lakes, and this is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives, and we're looking at childbearing, identity, gender, fatherlessness, fatherhood, motherhood, parenting, what it means to grow up in this world, and I think growing up for children and adults. We would like to hear your thoughts about this program. And you can get those thoughts to us in two different ways. One is to call the station radio. I call the station telephone at 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave us a message, and it will get to Peaches and Me. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6. Or send an email to info@madeofclay.org. That, too, will get to both Peaches and Me. You can also go to madeofclay.org and listen to any one of about 650 or 700 hours of shows. In the past, most of them are interviews with people about their lives, where we get into some of this complexity. But more recently, they're facing our lives, where we're taking on a single issue or a wicked problem of an issue and trying to unravel it in a way that we might live it with more integrity.
Yeah. So, and as we were talking about some of the barriers and some of the conflicts and the walls that get raised against having these conversations, we are trying to break that down. And you could help us break that down by calling in and writing in and emailing us to join into this conversation and give us your thoughts. So right. We invite you to do that.
And by giving us your thoughts and dialing in, we can include you in the panel, because we can comfortably have up to 5 people in these conversations, or maybe 6, depending. We are open to showing up with each other.
Nice.
Peaches, it's wonderful to work with you.
Thanks, Eric. Same here. I love it.
And I think we will go in more deeply to the problem of fatherlessness, but this is a conversation that we need to have first.
Yeah, that was my feeling. Fantastic.